He hailed Haney via his call sign and told him that they had received a visitor and to get down to the shed with an extra hood on the double. Then, he motioned for Yashinsky to follow him outside. Once they were out of earshot, he said, "We're going to have to pack up. We can't stay here. It's not safe."
"What are you talking about?"
"Johansson probably didn't give this location to his dispatcher, but I'll bet he gave it to the cell leader."
"Is that the one from Johansson's phone?" she asked. "Dominic?"
"According to Sparman, his full name is Dominic Gashi, probably an alias."
"GRU?"
"That'd be my guess," said Harvath.
"So what do you want to do?"
"I want to get the hell out of Sweden, but first, I want to get my hands on this Dominic character."
"How are we going to do that?"
"We're going to have to ask for help," he replied.
"From who?"
"The local police." When Harvath rolled up to the wrecking yard in a Swedish police car, Chief Inspector Nyström's first instinct had been to draw his pistol. He didn't, deciding instead to honor his promise to hear the American out. Opening the gate, he allowed the car to pass through, and then closed and locked it behind him.
"Where's my officer?"
Nyström asked, once Harvath had stopped and gotten out.
"He's safe."
"That was going to be my second question. This is Johansson's vehicle. Where is he?"
"He's not far," said Harvath.
"What's this all about?"
"I think Johansson should tell you."
The moment Harvath's hand went inside his coat, the chief inspector went for his gun.
"Easy," cautioned Harvath, showing him the phone. "Everything's okay."
"Keep your hands where I can see them,"
Nyström ordered, uncomfortable with all the subterfuge.
"Chief Inspector, you've got a very dangerous cell of Russian operatives here on Gotland. The cell includes a contingent of Russian Special Forces soldiers. Of the 6 Swedish nationals who are members of the cell, your officer, Magnus Johansson, is one."
Nyström wasn't quite sure how to respond.
"Johansson? He's an exemplary officer. You had better have some very strong evidence."
"I do," said Harvath,
as he played back a portion of the audio from the equipment shed. The chief inspector listened in disbelief. He wanted to say that it wasn't Johansson, that it couldn't be. But the voice on the recording was unmistakable. It was Johansson, and he had incriminated himself by admitting to the unthinkable.
"I'm sure you recognize his voice," said Harvath.
Nyström nodded.
"Yes, that's him. Where is he?"
Harvath walked back to the squad car and popped the trunk. Coming to join him, the chief inspector looked inside. There, still hogtied and hooded, was Johansson in his uniform. Harvath pulled the hood from his head so Nyström could be certain. Reaching up, the chief inspector took hold of the lid and slammed it shut.
"What is it you want?"
He was angry, and understandably so.
Harvath needed to be very careful about how he threaded this needle.
"First and foremost, I believe I want the same thing you do."
"Which is what?"
"For the Russians not to invade Gotland," said Harvath. "For them not to invade anywhere. For them to be contained."
"But that is not my job. That's the job of the Swedish military, the government."
"Have you seen their plan to protect Gotland?"
"No,"
said Nyström.
"I have only heard about it."
"I've actually seen it," said Harvath. "In fact, the entire American military has seen it, and we have been begging Sweden to change it. Their plan is to wait for help, to wait for NATO to come and liberate Gotland."
"I have always heard they would bring in more troops from the mainland."
"How?"
"I don't know. By boat, I guess, or by air."
"Russian submarines and Russian fighter jets will make sure those troops never arrive," Harvath remarked. "This island is too important to them. If it's worth invading, which it very much is to them, then it's worth defending. I guarantee you, Sweden will only risk so much to take it back. They will decide it's better to wait for help. And during that time, what do you think will happen? What will happen to you and your fellow police officers? What will happen to the people of Gotland, to the business owners like your uncle? What will happen to them if they do not comply with the Russian occupiers?"
The chief inspector didn't need to think about what would happen. He already knew. European history was all too clear on that subject. Sweden had dodged the horrors of Nazi attack and occupation, but only because it had declared itself neutral and had helped feed the Third Reich's war machine
by supplying it with much-needed iron ore, steel, and machine parts. It was an inconvenient truth, if ever there was one.
"I still don't understand what you want from me," said Nystrom.
"I want you to help me get Dominic Gashi, the cell leader."
"I can't do that."
"What are you talking about?" Harbath replied. "You took an oath to protect this island."
"I took an oath to uphold the law."
Harvath shook his head.
"This needs to be brought to the attention of the garrison commander," Nystrom continued. "This is a national security matter."
"It's bigger than that," said Harvath. "It's an international security matter. Do you know what happens if the military or the government gets involved? Dominic Gashi gets arrested. Then he gets a lawyer. And at some point way in the future, he gets a trial. In the meantime, you saw what happened in Rome last night."
"The bombing? Yes, it was terrible."
"Well, that's what Europe gets. Attack after attack. Maybe even some right here in Sweden."
"I think you're exaggerating," said the chief inspector.
"I wish I was," Harvath replied. "The fact is, the only link we have is Gashi."
"How am I supposed to believe you? You lied to me. You told me you were here to meet Lars Lund, to plan a pending military exercise."
"Yeah. The most important exercise of all, the rescue of Gotland. That's why I'm here. And no, I didn't lie to you. As part of my assignment, I was supposed to figure out how to prevent a rescue from even being necessary. That's why I was looking for Staffan Sparman. If we could locate and identify the Russian cell, our job was to break it up. Then we were to take whatever we had learned and climb the ladder, go after the people on the next level. My job is to prevent a war. We're trying to stop the Russians before they can launch any invasion. But make no mistake, they're coming for Gotland. Now maybe the Swedish military can repel their attack. I don't know. Maybe Gotland can hold out until NATO comes to its rescue. But no matter what, people on your island, people you have sworn to protect, are going to die. I don't want that to happen. I know you don't want that to happen. And it doesn't have to happen, if we can get to Dominic Gashi."
The chief inspector put his fingers beneath his glasses and pinched the bridge of his nose. He then walked away from the patrol car in order to think. Harvath watched as the man, torn, paced slowly up and down in the wrecking yard. There were only two potential outcomes. Either Nystrom was going to help, or he wasn't. Harvath hoped he chose option A, because if the man chose option B, it was going to get very bad very quickly. Leaning against the car, Harvath watched as his breath turned to steam and rose into the night air. His Sig Sauer was tucked in his jeans at the small of his back, and the taser, with a brand new cartridge, was in his left coat pocket. Finally, the chief inspector came back over.
"If I help you," he said, "I want the information about every single person in that cell, especially the locals."
"Done," said Harvath.
"And," Nystrom added, "whatever it is you need, it can't appear to have any official police sanction, and it absolutely cannot appear to have come from me."
Harvath understood the man's position, but his conditions were going to be a lot easier said than done, especially with what Harvath had in mind. Chapter 46. The first POC processing plant was a half hour north of Visby, and just inland from the coast. Its owner had been born and raised on the island. He had spent his entire life there, except for a 2-year period while serving in the Swedish military. What had intrigued Harvath the most about him, though, was that a quick scan of Facebook revealed him to be a member of the Gotland Runners Club. Not only did Nystrom know Martin Ingeson, but they were also friends. It was, the chief inspector admitted again, a small island. Trying to hew as close to Nystrom's conditions as possible, Harvath had suggested that the chief inspector characterize their middle-of-the-night visit to Ingeson as personal. "Friends don't wake friends up in the middle of the night," was the man's response. When they arrived at his home, the lights were on, and Ingeson was up waiting for them. Hearing the car pull into the drive, he met them at the front door. Martin Ingeson looked like a Viking. He was at least 6'4", with blue eyes, blonde hair, and a big blonde beard. His chest and arms were twice the size of Harvath's. the man could have passed for a competitor in the World's Strongest Man contest. It wouldn't have surprised Harvath in the least if he had spent his lunch breaks dragging truck tires around the parking lot. Ingerson invited them inside and led them back to the kitchen where he already had coffee ready. It was a modest home, paneled in blonde wood, with ceramic masonry stoves in several of the rooms they passed. The hallway was lined with family photos. Nystrom made the introductions, and they kept their voices low, so as not to wake Ingerson's wife and children.
"Anders tells me you're with NATO," the big man asked.
Harvath nodded.
"And he tells me you were in the military. Which branch?"
"Army, K-4.
"Norland's Dragoons,"
Harvath said respectfully.
Ingerson was impressed.
"You know it?"
He did. They were Sweden's crack ranger battalion, expert light infantry trained to carry out missions behind enemy lines.
"I started out with SEAL Team 2, said Harvath.
"We cross-trained with K-4 in Lapland.
Up until that point, I had thought Alaska was the coldest place on Earth."
The big man grinned.
"SEALs are excellent warriors.
But I think the cold water eventually breaks you.
That's why you retire to places like Florida and Texas."
Harvath laughed.
"In addition to nice weather, those states also have no income tax, are good places to raise a family, and don't mind if you own guns."
"Fair points," Ingerson conceded, as he poured coffee and pushed a plate of pastries forward.
"So, what are we doing in my kitchen?"
Nystrom had made the introduction. That was as far as he was prepared to go. "I'm going to take my coffee into the living room." Harvath waited until he was gone, and then began speaking to his host.
"I wanted to talk with you about one of your employees."
"Which one?"
"Dominic Gashi."
"He's one of my best employees. What about him?"
"How well do you know him?"
Harvath asked. "He's smart. He works hard, and he's always on time."
"What else should I know about him?"
asked Ingerson.
"What about his background?"
The big man thought for a moment.
"From what I understand, he's from a small village in Kosovo. His family, most of whom are dead, were in the butchery business. That's about all I know."
"Have you ever met any of them?"
"No, I have not."
"Have you ever heard him speak Albanian or Serbian?"
asked Harvath.
"No."
"Have you ever seen him reading any books, magazines, or anything else in Albanian or Serbian?"
Ingerson shook his head.
"Have you ever heard him speaking Russian?"
Harvath asked. "Is that what this is all about? You think Gashi is Russian,
not Kosovar?"
"Yes. In fact, we think he's GRU.
Ingerson's eyes almost popped out of his head.
"Russian military intelligence. Gashi? That's impossible."
"Why?"
"It just doesn't fit."
"Really?"
replied Harvath.
"You were K-4. You were trained to conduct reconnaissance and sabotage behind enemy lines. If you were Russia and you were going to place a deep cover operative on Gotland, exactly what type of person would you choose?"
"Probably a man just like Dominic Gashi,"
he finally admitted, after several moments of thought. "I'd take advantage of Sweden's soft spot for immigrants, especially from conflict-torn countries. And I'd place him in an industry few people want to know anything about, much less be a part of, like animal processing."
"There you go," said Harvath.
"Of all people, I should have seen it."
"If there was nothing suspicious about him, there's no reason you should have suspected anything."
"So, you think he's here as part of some GRU operation?
To do what?"
"We think he's running a cell responsible for gathering intelligence and conducting sabotage in advance of a Russian invasion."
Again, the big man shook his very big head.
"I knew it."
"You knew what?"
"I always suspected the Russians had operatives here. It just makes sense. Strategically, they need Gotland. Nobody, though, has ever been able to catch them."
"Well, they're here," said Harvath. "And part of the cell includes a contingent of Spetsnaz soldiers."
"I'm not surprised," he replied. "That's exactly the kind of thing K-4 would do. But if you know all this, why hasn't Anders arrested them?"
"That's why I came to see you," said Harvath. "How do I put this appropriately? The way some of the intelligence was gathered makes it difficult for the chief inspector to use in court."
Ingerson nodded knowingly.
I am assuming, based on how it was gathered, that it would be difficult for any Swedish authorities to use this intelligence as well?
Correct. That's one of the reasons I was brought in. My team and I allow Sweden to keep its hands clean.
I think the Americans call it plausible deniability.
Correct again, replied Harvath.
What do you wish to do with Dominic Gashi?
We just want to talk with him.
Ingerson laughed and repeated the word talk with air quotes.
He may not want to talk with us, said Harvath, but he doesn't have a choice. We believe he is part of an overall operation to weaken NATO and prepare the battlefield for an ultimate Russian invasion of the Baltic states.
Which is why they would need Gotland to control the Baltic Sea.
Exactly, Harvath stated,
relieved to be speaking with someone who understood the big picture.
America doesn't want to go to war, and we're certain that Sweden doesn't want to either. In our opinion, all that matters
is stopping the Russians, no matter what it takes.
Harvath nodded.
That is our position.
It's the right position, replied Ingerson. What can I do to help you?
Do you have a picture of Gashi?
Sure. I can pull his file from the company server. What else?
I have spoken with two of his associates, neither of whom has ever been to his home. Can you give me some idea of where he lives?
I can do better than that, the big man replied. I'll take you right to him.
Chapter 47 Gashi lived in a crappy, run-down cabin on a poorly maintained piece of land in the middle of nowhere. Ingerson knew it because he had driven the man home after he'd had too much to drink at the company Christmas party. Gashi allegedly augmented his income from the processing plant by acting as a caretaker. He worked for several mainland homeowners who rented out their beach houses to the tourists who flocked to Gotland in the summer. Off-season, he simply dropped by once a week to make sure pipes hadn't frozen and nothing had been stolen. It was easy money. What he did with it, though, was anyone's guess. He definitely wasn't putting it into where he lived. Haney assembled the drone and got it up overhead. Harvath told him to take his time. He definitely didn't want a repeat of Norway. Slowly, Haney conducted a reconnaissance of the property. In addition to the cabin, there was a detached garage, a woodshed, and an old, decrepit outhouse. Harvath, as usual, stood next to him, watching the feed on the tablet.
"Looks pretty quiet," said Haney.
"I know," Harvath replied. "That's what bothers me."
"Maybe the guy's just inside sleeping."
Harvath knew there wasn't a chance in hell that was so. Johansson had already admitted that Nikolai had called Gashi, filling him in on everything that had happened at O'Leary's, and that Gashi had then called him. There was no way that Gashi would just roll over and go to bed at that point. He'd want to know what Johansson had uncovered, and when Johansson failed to report back in, Gashi would be forced to assume the worst. If Gashi was inside that cabin, he'd probably be sitting behind the front door with a shotgun, ready to blast the first person who showed up. More than likely, he had already taken off. But to where? Unless he had a boat or a plane, there wasn't much he could do besides go to ground. Harvath decided he needed to see the cabin for himself. Looking at Sloane, he said,
"You're with me. Haney stays on the drone. Stalin and Palmer will come in via the woods to the south. Barton's had the longest day of all of us. He'll watch the vehicles. Yashinsky, you can stay with Barton or come with us. It's your call."
Yashinsky hadn't expected to be in a position where she had to decide whether to opt in or opt out.
"I'm in. I'll go with you."
"Okay,"
said Harvath, pleased with her answer.
"You're with us."
Then addressing the team, he said,
"Everyone should absolutely be expecting booby traps. Is that clear?"
"Roger that," they all replied.
Ingerson had wanted to be part of the raid. He had even volunteered to carry his own weapon, a short-barreled tactical rifle he kept in violation of Swedish law. By the looks of him, he was no stranger to dodging bullets and kicking serious ass, but Harvath had politely said no. The former K-4 Army Ranger was too valuable a find. A pro-Western local with elite military training skilled at surviving behind enemy lines was something Harvath would rather keep as a future asset already in place. In short, as formidable as he was, fortunately, they didn't need him. Harvath's team was more than well-equipped to handle this. Taking the lead, Harvath cut across the adjacent property and approached the cabin from the east, with Ashby and Yashinsky tight behind him. They moved as one unit, each covering their respective pieces of the pie, weapons up and ready to engage. They were carrying a new close-quarters weapon called the Sig Rattler, a compact tactical rifle in the 300 blackout caliber. It was a nice fat round that packed high speed and an incredible punch. Theirs had collapsible stocks and were outfitted with suppressors. They were super smooth and returned almost zero recoil. 200 meters out from the target, Harvath slowed down. They needed to be very careful now. As good as their goggles were, any tripwires would be basically invisible. Step by careful step, they moved forward. Every tree, every rock, every pile of leaves might hide a Claymore-style anti-personnel device. Coming up from the south, Palmer and Stalin exhibited the same degree of caution. There was every reason to believe that this cabin would be as well protected as the one in Norway. In addition to tripwires, Harvath was also concerned about landmines with pressure plates. Via a submarine a few miles off the coast, it would have been nothing for Russian commando teams to get all sorts of equipment onto Gotland. Harvath wasn't taking anything for granted. As they neared the cabin, he had his team find cover and then called for Haney to bring the drone in for an extreme close-up. Harvath didn't have the tablet with him, so he had to go by the play-by-play coming in over his earpiece from Haney. Garage windows impenetrable to camera, possibly painted or just really dirty. Moving on to woodshed. Several seconds later, he said, "Woodshed appears to be clear. 3, maybe 4 cords. Nothing else visible. No clear angles on outhouse interior. Proceed with caution in regard to all structures." Harvath waved his team forward. The first building they came upon when accessing the property was the garage. Its windows had been painted black. He tried the main door. It had been locked. Pulling out a short crowbar affixed to his pack, he went to work. Seconds later, there was a snap, along with the sound of a piece of metal skittering into the garage. The door was open. Lifting it, Harvath looked inside. In the center of the small space was a vehicle covered by a tarp. Approaching it, Harvath flipped back a corner of the canvas. Underneath was a 1990 Mercedes-Benz 250 GD SUV. Flipping up his goggles, he pulled out his flashlight and turned on the low beam. The vehicle's color was olive, an exact match for the mark he had found on Lars Lund's Volkswagen. Pulling the cover the rest of the way off, he walked around the front of the vehicle and found damage along the right front quarter panel. This was the car that had been used to kill Lars. He was certain of it. Turning off his light, he flipped his goggles back down and allowed his eyes to readjust. Then he checked out the woodshed and the outhouse. They were both clear. He asked Haney to do a final flyby and search the windows of the cabin. He, Ashby, and Yashinsky took cover positions while he did. It took several minutes for him to scan each of the tiny openings and what lay inside. Finally, he reported, "No heat signatures and no movement from inside." This only made Harvath more nervous. Had Dominic Gashi been inside, there was the hope that the cabin hadn't been wired to explode. The Russians weren't big on suicide. They might drink themselves to death, but that was seen as a virtue, religiously committed to over a significant period of time. Booby traps were something else entirely. An empty house, previously inhabited by an assumed GRU intelligence officer, now believed to be on the run, could only be bad news. There were dozens of ways that it could be wired to explode. A device could be affixed to the door and detonate on entry. It could be rigged to a specific floorboard and explode once an unlucky member of the entry team put weight on it. It could be attached to a closet door or a dresser drawer just waiting for some poor bastard to open it. The options were both endless and terrifying. Harvath was aware of them all, and he took the lead, starting with the front door. After checking, as best he could, to make sure it wasn't wired, he pushed it open with the toe of his boot and stepped back. Nothing happened. Relieved, Harvath slowly crept inside. The structure was built around a rough stone fireplace, big enough to walk into. Horns and antlers were nailed to the walls. There was a variety of dead animals in various stages of taxidermy scattered throughout the space. A rough-hewn railing blocked off an elevated sleeping area above. The entire place smelled like mold. Harvath scanned his weapon from left to right as he and his team made entry. "Clear," he heard Ashby eventually yell. Yashinsky responded in kind. "Clear." Reluctantly, Harvath added his assessment.
"Clear."
Dominic Gashi was not here. Rapidly, they searched chests and wardrobes, under the couch and inside the tiny bathroom. There was no sign of the man. There was, though, a sign that he had recently been there. Seeing a bright blue kettle sitting on the stove, Harvath reached out and placed his hand above it. It was still warm. Gashi had been here, and not that long ago. He gestured Ashby and Yashinsky over to show them what he had found. Each of them touched the kettle, and then, nodding, they fanned out and conducted a renewed search.
"Friendlies," Palmer said over the radio, as he and Stalin arrived at the front door.
Knocking twice, they waited for a response, and when Ashby gave the all clear, they entered. Looking up from her search, she pointed at the kettle on the stove, indicated it was still warm, and then went back to what she was doing.
"I think I've got something,"
Harvath said from upstairs in the sleeping loft. Inside a small cubby, he had found a key rack. On it was an assortment of keys, each with a brightly colored plastic tag. Inside each tag was a piece of paper with what looked like an address. One of the pegs was empty. Explaining what he had found, Harvath slung his rattler and went back to his search. He was looking for any information about Dominic Gashi and what he was doing on Gotland. Minutes later, as Stalin was scanning the man's bookshelves, it was Chase who called out, "I may have something." Harvath came to the railing.
"What is it?"
"Looks like a ledger."
"What kind of ledger?"
"A property ledger. There's a chart here with multiple addresses. Then there are dates last visited, status, repairs needed, that kind of thing."
"Read out the addresses," said Harvath,
as he went back, pulled the keys off the rack, and lined them up on the bed. As Chase read off the addresses, he discarded the corresponding sets of keys. At the very end, he was able to identify the property to which the matching set belonged. Pulling out his cell phone, he looked it up on his mapping app and then called Nystrom.
"Yes," the chief inspector said. "I know it. There are a lot of houses on that stretch of beach. Some are quite close together, but at this time of year it's normally quiet. Those are almost entirely summer cottages."
Harvath, convinced that he knew where Dominic Gashi had gone to ground, asked Nystrom for a favor. A big one.
"I don't think I can do that," the Swedish police officer answered.
"We don't have a choice," replied Harvath. "Beyond the public safety concern, if you don't, everything we have done up to this point is worthless, and we will also have handed the Russians a huge leg up."
Nystrom, as was his custom, took several moments to consider what Harvath was asking of him. Each of the Americans' requests seemed to be more involved and more dangerous than the last. Finally, the chief inspector said,
"I'll do it, but only on one condition."
Harvath wasn't a fan of conditions, but he also wasn't in a position to say no, especially not now.
"What is it?"
"After this, it's over. All of it. You and your team get on your plane and are gone. Before sunrise."
Harvath had no idea if he'd be able to live up to that kind of promise or not. There was no way he was leaving Gotland without Gashi in tow. But he needed to humor Nystrom. In an attempt to prolong the chief inspector's cooperation, Harvath agreed.
"We'll be gone by sunrise. You can count on it."
"I'll try to pull together what you asked for," the man replied. "Meet me in a half hour."
Harvath hung up the phone and immediately began forming plans B, C, and D. He had very little faith that what they were about to attempt was actually going to work. Chapter 48. As far as beach houses went, the tiny rental near the village of Neham was not at all what Harvath had expected. When the sun was up, it probably had a million-dollar view of the ocean, but in the dark, it resembled a double-wide trailer with a long covered porch and a smattering of cheap outdoor furniture. By the time Chief Inspector Nystrom got to the rendezvous location, Haney had already done multiple drone passes over the target. "What is the situation?" Nystrom said, as he climbed out of Johansson's squad car dressed in a patrolman's uniform. "All quiet," Haney replied. "No movement inside." "Where are your people?" Using a still from the drone, Harvath marked the locations on his tablet and then asked,
"Were you able to get what I asked for?"
Nystrom tilted his head toward the back seat of the cruiser. Harvath opened the door and removed a duffel bag. Dropping it on the lid of the trunk, he unzipped it and inventoried the contents. There was a regulation police uniform, boots, duty belt, cap, and jacket. There was also body armor.
"Were you able to get the other item?"
He nodded and knocked on the side of the trunk. Harvath cleared his gear off the lid and opened it. He ignored Johansson, who was still lying inside, and grabbed the plastic case. The chief inspector still hadn't decided what to do with him. Fortunately, Johansson was off duty when Harvath caught him. Neither he nor his patrol car, which was a take-home vehicle, would be missed until tomorrow night. Closing the lid, Harvath put the case on the trunk and opened it up. Inside was a tear gas launcher with several canisters.
"I'm hoping we don't need that," said Nystrom.
"Me too," replied Harvath.
Latching the case, he handed it to Haney and told him,
"Get this to Sloan and then hustle back."
The Marine accepted the case and struck off into the pines on the side of the road, disappearing into a gathering mist. "What do we know about the nearby houses?" the chief inspector asked. Picking up his tablet from where he had laid it on the roof of the patrol vehicle, Harvath pulled up another photo.
"There are four of them. As far as we can tell, they're all empty.
But if we did have to go hot, and a round over-penetrated and exited our target house,
there is a possibility it could enter any one of them."
"Based on your conversation with Martin Ingeson, I overheard that you were a Navy SEAL."
Harvath nodded.
"I assume you were taught to control your rounds?"
"It's not my rounds I'm worried about," he replied. "Dominic Gashi, or whatever his real name is, may have Sparmon Spetsnaz operatives in there. It doesn't take much to get those boys into a gunfight. And when they're triggered, they don't give a damn where their rounds go."
Nystrom took one of his long, pregnant pauses as he tried to figure out the best course forward.
"How do you know the other houses aren't occupied?"
"No lights on inside. No cars outside.
We looked through the windows using IR and thermal." "There's no cars outside the target house either."
"True. But that could be for several reasons.
At the cabin Ingeson sent us to, we found an olive Mercedes SUV under a tarp. If you re-examine Lars Lund's vehicle back at the wrecking yard, you should see damage to the left rear quarter panel that contains traces of the same paint."
"So, you did notice something when you examined the car?"
"I noticed lots of things," said Harvath. "It's part of my job. It wasn't worth mentioning at the time. Now, it is."
"Fair enough. What other reasons might there not be any cars near the target house?"
"The house may have been a fallback location for Gashi and the Spetsnaz. If they're hiding here, they wouldn't want to give their presence away. I disabled their two vehicles in Visby. If they got them working again, maybe they drove here and hid them. They also could have Ubered to a location nearby and hiked the rest of the way in. Same with Gashi."
It made sense to Nystrom, and he nodded. "Before we do anything, I have to check the nearby houses."
"I just told you they're empty."
The chief inspector held up his hand.
"And I'm the one who might have to answer to a police review board at some point. Change clothes. While you do, I'll check the houses for myself."
Reluctantly, Harvath agreed. He waited for Haney to reappear and then sent the two men off together. Opening the trunk of the car, he removed Johansson's hood and peeled the duct tape from his mouth.
"Are you thirsty?" he asked.
The man nodded. Nystrom had some water bottles in a crate in the trunk. Grabbing the corrupt cop by his tunic, Harvath lifted him into a kneeling position. Then, opening one of the bottles, he tilted it so that he could drink. Once Johansson had had enough, Harvath screwed the cap back on the bottle and set it back down in the crate with the others.
"Thank you," said Johansson. "May I urinate?"
There was a time in Harvath's past where he probably would have vented his anger at the corrupt cop by slamming the lid down on the man's head. Instead, he looked down at him and said,
"Be my guest."
As he began to object, Harvath tore off a new piece of duct tape, slapped it across his mouth, and put the hood back over his head. Closing the lid, he picked up the duffel bag, dropped it on the trunk, and began to gear up. By the time Nystrom and Haney returned, Harvath looked like a model Swedish policeman. The uniform fit so well, he could have been posing for Officer of the Month, or the much-maligned yet extremely popular Swedish policeman's calendar. "Put your coat on," ordered Nystrom. Then, pointing at Harvath's rattler, added, "Sidearm only. In its holster, nice and easy. We're just two cops responding to a suspicious activity call." Harvath appreciated the man's attention to detail, but he hadn't intended to bring the rattler. No need to tip off Dominic Gashi that anything was out of the ordinary. Haney did a final team radio check, and then flashed a thumbs up. They were all ready to go. Harvath looked at the chief inspector and said, "Just two cops, responding to a suspicious activity call. A casual knock and talk." Chapter 49. In their patrol uniforms, they both got into the patrol vehicle and headed down the narrow beach road toward the house. A light fog had begun to gather. Nystrom was on edge. Harvath could see it by how tightly he gripped the steering wheel.
"Everything's going to be okay," said Harvath.
"Have you done this a lot?"
"Use the police as a ruse in order to capture a bad guy?"
The chief inspector nodded.
"I have, actually."
"Where?"
Harvath thought for a moment. "The last time was in Germany. Similar to this. We had an actual Bundespolizei officer, in uniform, as another member of my team posed as a plainclothes detective from the criminal Polizei."
"I assumed it worked, or we wouldn't be doing this, right?"
"It worked perfectly. The target was also a Russian. They treat the police in their own country with disdain. But when operating abroad, especially illegally, they're highly deferential to law enforcement. That's why I like this approach. It's safer. They don't want any trouble, so they go along with what a uniformed officer asks. By the time they realize what's happening, it's too late. You have them."
"And what happened to that Russian?" asked Nystrom.
"To be honest," replied Harvath, "I don't know. It was only my job to pick him up."
"Who hired you for the job?"
Harvath smiled. "I can't remember."
"I see," said the chief inspector, relaxing a little bit. "I imagine memory loss happens a lot in your business."
"I wouldn't know. I keep forgetting."
Nystrom grinned. He was fairly certain that the American was much more than just a NATO liaison. As they neared the house, the chief inspector said,
"Don't talk. Just follow my lead."
Harvath nodded.
"Don't worry. My Swedish isn't that good. That's why I have you along. I plan to let you do all the talking."
"Good. We'll start off with an inspection of the perimeter. You still have your flashlight, the one that's brighter than mine?" Harvath pulled it from his pocket and gave a quick flash against the palm of his hand.
"Okay, then," said Nystrom, pulling up near the house.
"Here we are." Reaching behind, he withdrew a handheld spotlight, plugged it into the cigarette lighter, and handed it to Harvath.
"Roll down your window, and sweep the light slowly across the house and around the perimeter."
Harvath did as the chief inspector had asked. When it was complete, he turned off the light, rolled up his window, and handed it back.
"What now?"
"Now," he said, lifting the microphone of his police radio to his mouth and pretending to toggle the talk button, "we call it in, and then we exit the vehicle." Harvath followed his lead and exited the vehicle. They both got their flashlights out and began sweeping the area with their beams. Then, slowly, they walked a complete circle around the house. Though he couldn't see his team set back in the trees, Harvath knew they were there. Curtains were drawn across most of the windows.
Where they could, they peered inside. Either housekeeping had never come after the last set of guests, or there were several people inside who had quickly scrambled for cover. There were coffee cups and dirty dishes visible in the kitchen. Nystrom rattled the back door to see if it was unlocked, and then kept moving. Eventually, they made it back around to the front of the structure. Walking up the front steps, the chief inspector approached the front door and gave a loud police knock. He allowed a few moments for a response, and when no one came to the door, he knocked again, even louder this time. He knew there were people inside, and he was making it quite obvious. Suddenly, they heard noises, as someone made his way to the door. In a move so subtle that Nystrom didn't even see it, Harvath unfastened the safety mechanism on his holster. Fortunately, the Swedish police also carried the Sig Sauer, so he had been able to bring his own sidearm along. He stood half a step back, just behind the chief inspector's right side. He had wanted to be up front, but it was out of the question. Nystrom had to take point, as the encounter had to be done in Swedish. Having dated several Swedish flight attendants, Harbath spoke a little of the language, but it was composed of relatively useless words, pickup lines, a few naughty sentences, and drinking songs, and some tourist phrases he had used when he'd previously been over to visit. And, of course, it was all built upon the foundation of the first thing anyone learns in a foreign language, swear words. All of it was useless as the door opened, and Nystrom leaned in to engage. The first thing the man did was something Harvath had watched seasoned American cops do. The moment the door opened, he stuck the toe of his boot inside so that it couldn't be closed. As soon as Harvath saw him, he knew that they had their man. Gashi's Swedish was terrible, and he asked the police officer if he spoke English. As he had done with Harvath upon their first meeting, the chief inspector instantly transitioned over. "Good evening," he said. "Just a routine check. A neighbor called in a report of suspicious activity." Gashi looked around, trying to ascertain which neighbor it might have been, then flicked his eyes toward Harvath. "I haven't seen anything," he said. "Are you the owner of this house?"
"No, I'm the caretaker."
"Are you alone inside?"
"I'm sorry," Gashi replied. "What exactly is it you're looking for?"
"We're just here taking a look, and making sure everything is okay," Nystrom reassured him. "It's quite late. Are you living in this house?"
"Me? No, I have a full-time job at First Park. I do my caretaking on the side, at night and on weekends."
"May I see some identification, please?"
"Of course," the man replied, flicking his eyes toward Harvath again. If Harvath didn't know any better, he would have sworn that the man had recognized him from somewhere, but that was impossible. What Harvath couldn't know was that Gashi recognized him from the CCTV footage that Johansson had pulled from Visby Hospital. Regardless, Harvath's spidey sense was officially tingling. Transitioning the flashlight to his left hand, he let his right hand drop and hover just above his holster. "Keep an eye on his hands," he thought, as Dominic Gashi reached back as if to retrieve his wallet. Instead, the man pulled out something that looked like a Victorian surgical instrument. It was long and highly polished, catching what little light there was in the fog. Gashi slashed in a downward motion with amazing speed. His target? Chief Inspector Nystrom. Upon seeing the blade, Harvath reacted. He drove his left shoulder into Nystrom, trying to knock him out of the weapon's path. At the same time, he double-punched the tail cap of his flashlight, triggering an eruption of strobe lights. He tilted the beam as best he could, hoping to catch Gashi in the face to blind him as he drew his pistol. He fired twice at the man's left knee, and then two more times into his left shoulder. He wanted him incapacitated, not dead. The Russian dropped the knife and it clattered to the ground as he stumbled backward. Stepping in, Harvath kicked it aside and shoved Nystrom fully out of the way. Holstering his pistol, he quickly patted Gashi down to make sure he didn't have any more weapons. Then, grabbing him by the collar, he yanked him away from the house and back toward the patrol car. The chief inspector was slow to follow. When Harvath looked back, he could see that the Swede was badly injured. He was bleeding profusely from his left arm and part of his chest. He had raised his arm to shield himself from Gashi's knife, which had cut right through the chunky plastic strap of his digital watch and deep into his forearm, and had kept going across part of his chest, above where his vest was. The weapon was incredibly sharp, having cut through his jacket and the uniform beneath before slicing through his flesh, revealing bone. Dumping Gashi behind the patrol vehicle, Harvath buffaloed him with the butt of his Sig Sauer and gave the signal for his team to move in. Just as they began to appear from the trees, Gashi's own team appeared in the windows and the doorway of the house and opened fire. Chapter 50. Nystrom, despite his injuries, found a reservoir of strength and summoned an incredible burst of speed. As he caught up with Harvath behind the patrol vehicle, his pistol was already out, and he was putting rounds on the house.
"Where's your med kit?"
Harvath yelled, as he slammed a fresh magazine into his SIG and returned fire at the Spetsnaz soldiers.
"I'll be okay."
Nystrom was bleeding a lot and starting to look weak. He clearly needed medical attention, and soon. But before that could happen, they needed to neutralize the threat inside the house. Hailing Sloan over his radio, Harvath said,
"Hit them with the gas."
Seconds later, the first tear gas canister sailed out of the launcher, crashed through one of the windows, and began aerosolizing inside. Quickly, Sloan worked her way through the trees and pumped three more rounds into different parts of the house. Harvath had made the rules of engagement crystal clear. Whoever stepped outside holding a weapon was a legitimate target. With tear gas filling the structure, Harvath secured Gashi with flex cuffs and then searched for the medical bag in the patrol car. Finding it, he returned to Nystrom. The chief inspector was leaning against the left front tire, trying to use the engine block as cover. Laying the bag on the ground next to him, Harvath tore it open and removed what he needed to tend to the injured man. Around them, gunfire crackled as his team returned fire and put rounds on the beach house. Windows shattered, and shards of glass went flying as pieces of wood splintered in all directions. Using a pair of shears to cut away the clothing, Harvath examined Nystrom's wound. He was bleeding badly, but the wound wasn't spurting. Applying a tourniquet could mean the loss of his arm. He ripped open packages of bandages and used an Israeli battle dressing to stanch the bleeding. It was all he could do for the moment. Taking the cop's empty sidearm, he ejected the spent magazine, flicked it aside, and inserted a new one.
"You're topped up," he said,
as he depressed the slide release and handed the weapon back to the chief inspector. Popping up over the hood, Harvath focused on the front door. When two Spetsnaz operatives emerged, choking on tear gas, but with weapons still in their hands, he and his team let their rounds fly. Both men dropped dead, right there on the doorstep. From the rear of the house came the sound of more gunfire. Harvath knew that meant additional Spetsnaz operatives were likely trying to escape via the back door. Three more Russian soldiers appeared at the front door, stumbling over the bodies of their dead comrades, but with their hands held high. Unlike his lousy Swedish, Harvath actually spoke some passable Russian, and he yelled out a series of commands, which the remaining men obeyed. He warned them to stay face down on the ground, and said that if they did not, they would be shot. With the three Spetsnaz lying in the dirt, plus the two dead at the door, that made five. He radioed Sloan, who told him they'd killed three more who had come running out the back with their guns blazing. That brought the total to eight, the same number of men that had been seen running at the Sparman farm. Harvath glanced down at Nystrom. He was bleeding through the thick bandages. They couldn't wait any longer. Harvath had to get him to a hospital. Though it had taken multiple rounds, the police vehicle was still functional. Haney helped load the chief inspector into the passenger seat. He left the medical kit so that Stalin could tend to Gashi. And after a brief rundown of what he wanted everyone to do, Harvath lit up the light bar and raced for the hospital in Visby. In a police car in the early Sunday morning hours before dawn, with no one on the roads and no fear of being pulled over, Harvath should have been able to make the half-hour trip to Visby in 15 minutes. The fog, though, had gotten worse, and he was forced to drive more slowly than he would have liked. On the flip side, it might have been for the best, as the fog provided them with a modicum of concealment. A bullet-ridden police car, driven by an officer no one on the island recognized, would have raised a lot of alarms. As absolutely messed up as everything had been, they still had managed to keep most of the operation quiet. Harvath kept Nystrom engaged by talking to him and asking lots of questions. They made it to the hospital in just over 20 minutes, which meant that, for the conditions, Harvath had still been driving way too fast. Skidding up to the emergency room entrance, Harvath saw the red-headed nurse at the desk inside and waved for her to come out and help. Exiting the vehicle, he came around to the side and opened the passenger door for Nystrom.
"We made it," said Harvath. "You're going to be okay."
"Thank you,"
the chief inspector replied. His voice was weak, his eyes a little glassy. As the nurse came running out, pushing a wheelchair, she already had two doctors in tow behind her.
"Knife wound, left arm and left side of the torso," Harvath said to them. "He has lost a lot of blood."
They positioned the wheelchair next to the vehicle, carefully lifted the policeman out, and transitioned him over. The nurse recognized Harvath from earlier, but Nystrom hadn't bothered introducing him. Now he was back, wearing a Swedish police uniform, and speaking in American-accented English, not Swedish. She didn't really know what to make of it.
"He's a good man," said Harvath, interrupting her thoughts. "Take care of him."
As the doctors rushed the chief inspector inside, she nodded and then turned to follow them. At the doorway, she turned back around, but the American had already gotten back into the patrol vehicle and had disappeared into the mist. Chapter 51. The team met back at the wrecking yard. After the rental house had been compromised, Nystrom had agreed to let Harvath and his people use the office there as a secure location until they left Gotland. Neither his uncle nor any employees would show up there until Monday morning. Harvath had a lot of loose ends to tie up. What's more, he was only going to get one shot. If he screwed up, he wouldn't be able to come back and fix them later. It would be too late. He needed to think. In fact, what he really needed was coffee. Hopping into the Camry, Chase left the yard and drove back to the gas station mini-mart, one of the few 24-hour places on Gotland, and returned with supplies. They had left the rental house so quickly that no one had packed up the kitchen. With a cup of hot coffee in his hand, Harvath sat at a battered work table jotting down notes. Under the heading of "absolutely unbelievable" was the fact that Johansson had survived the shootout. Multiple rounds had pierced the trunk of the police cruiser, but not a single one had touched him. God must have intended for the corrupt cop to do a very lengthy prison sentence. Then, in his own category, was Sparman. He had been trussed up with flex cuffs, hooded, gagged, and left in the minivan up the road from the beach house. At some point very soon, his mother was going to start looking into what had happened to him. On top of the treasonous twosome, there were the three surviving Spetsnaz soldiers, also bound, hooded, and gagged at the wrecking yard. Harvath hadn't decided what to do with any of them yet. Right now, the only captive whom Harvath cared anything about was Dominic Gashi. Gashi was the key to the next level. Fortunately, Harvath's shots had been well placed, and none of Gashi's injuries was life-threatening. The wounds probably hurt like hell, which was okay, but more important, the Russian would survive. Stalin had done an excellent job of patching him up. It was likely that Gashi would need surgery to remove the bullets from his left knee and shoulder, but that was so far down Harvath's list that he couldn't have been bothered to care. Hell, where Gashi was ultimately headed, he didn't have a lot of need for healthy knees and shoulders. Harvath was more concerned with making sure Nystrom was covered. Carl Pedersen had already reached out to a colleague at Must. He replied that, though Harvath's operation hadn't been officially sanctioned, if it truly had disrupted a Russian cell intent on promoting a Russian invasion of Gotland, they could handle the cleanup. He had also said that if the Russians had been involved in killing Lars Lund, and if Harvath had exacted revenge, the Swedish government would probably give him a medal. If not, Must definitely would. Of course, Must would need all the evidence, as well as the names of those involved, especially the Swedish nationals collaborating with the Russians. Harvath didn't have a problem with Must having any of the information. They would do the right thing with it. His biggest concern was making sure that Nystrom was properly recognized and not thrown under the bus for his involvement. From what Pedersen had told him, Must was going to make sure Nystrom came out on top. They were already launching a team from Stockholm to come over and deal with the beach house, the dead Spetsnaz operatives, and the prisoners. All the prisoners, that was, except for one. Harvath and the team were taking Gashi back with them. The Must team would also be arranging to bring back Lars Lund's body. There was talk of a search for Russian weapon caches on the island, which probably would take place after Must interrogators were able to spend some time with the surviving Spetsnaz operatives. From there, they would concoct a narrative and decide how the story would play out. Harvath, though, would already be off of Gotland and on to the next chapter, all within the promised 48 hours. How quickly that next chapter would be written was now the biggest question. Dominic Gashi had not proven to be very cooperative. Harvath's standard operating procedure with injured detainees was that they were not to be given any pain medications if they refused to play ball. Gashi was refusing to play ball. Harvath had seen his kind before. He was a hard, seasoned Russian operative. It wouldn't be easy breaking him. In fact, it would take a lot of work. So Harvath had decided to bring in a specialist to speed things up. He would be flying into Brussels later that day. All they had to do was to make sure Gashi remained stable until the man got there. Harvath felt confident that they could do that. What he wasn't so confident about was taking off. According to the pilots, the fog didn't look as if it was going to lift anytime soon. In fact, it was forecast to get worse. That opened up a whole new bunch of problems for the team. The longer they stayed in Sweden, the greater their chances of getting rolled up by the local authorities. Just because a Must team was coming over to sanitize everything didn't mean they'd go to bat for the Americans. Truth be told, they were counting on Harvath and his team to be long gone before they got there. That was what Harvath wanted, too. Their only option was to get to the airport, board the jet, and hope to get a break in the weather that might allow them to take off. Harvath had already contacted the pilots and told them to begin their pre-flight checks. He wanted to be wheels up at the very first opportunity. As they began to make ready at the wrecking yard, Yashinsky pulled him aside. She was understandably nervous, especially considering how she had lost her husband.
"Are you sure about this?" she asked. "Can we fly in this weather?"
"Our pilots are exceptional. If they say we can do it, we can do it."
"And if not?"
"Then we wait," said Harvath. "We're not going to take any unnecessary risks. Trust me."
Yashinsky wanted to trust him, but she didn't believe for a second that if it were a 50-50 shot, that he wouldn't push the crew to get the plane off the ground and up into the air. Though she was nervous, she tried to put her fear aside and focus on the task at hand. The Must team had transmitted instructions on how they wanted the prisoners secured. On Nystrom's behalf, they would reach out to his uncle and confirm that no one was coming in before Monday morning. It would be disastrous if an employee showed up and called the cops, or even worse, let the prisoners go. They took pictures and created dossiers on each one, so that the Must team would know who they were dealing with when they arrived. Then, after giving the men some water and a chance to relieve themselves, they secured them in a storage room, threw a tarp over the damaged police cruiser, and headed for the airport. Harvath broke his rule about pain medication and decided to sedate Gashi. It would make him more compliant and less likely to cause a scene at the airport. Pulling the minivan right up to the jet's air stairs, Stalin and Haney lifted the man out of the back and carried him on board. The fog was so murky, they were confident that no one had seen anything. Loading up the rest of their gear, they all climbed aboard, and the plane taxied out to the runway. There it sat, waiting for the fog to lift. This was always the part that gave Harvath the most concern. Being at the mercy of a control tower produced a certain amount of anxiety in him. You could do everything right, but if the police or some other actor came and yanked you off the plane before takeoff, that was it. It was over. The pilots were already well aware of how he felt. Though he didn't let Yashinsky overhear, he had told them that the moment they saw an opportunity, they were to take it.
He wanted to get out of Sweden as soon as possible. The minutes were ticking away.
"Can I ask you something?" he said,
bringing up a topic that had been on his mind all night.
"Sure," Monica replied. "What is it?"
"When Johansson had me in the equipment shed, how did you know I was in trouble?"
"I didn't. Not really. I just had a feeling."
"And that's why you had the gun?" he asked. She shrugged.